A few years ago, I must have said we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater once too often, because when I said it, the whole class burst out laughing. But that's okay. One thing I know about myself is I'm funniest when I'm not trying to be. I confess it, though, I do like the rustic saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. It very well describes a struggle that I've been involved with for many years. And in some ways, it defines my personal struggle with my own religious heritage. After teaching college, university, and seminary for 27 years, I'm confident that I'm not alone in that. Many students have shared with me their own struggle that's similar to my own. And I believe the same is true of many of my colleagues and friends. Some of us succeed in not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and some of us don't. And I'm certainly not here to blame anyone, but to share my own struggle with you and hopefully encourage you if you find yourself involved in this struggle. That saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, has an interesting history. I've heard one explanation of its origin that seems a little far-fetched to me. Allegedly, back in the Dark Ages, peasants bathed only once a week. They would fill a half barrel with soapy water, and the family members would take turns bathing in it. Of course, the father would go first, then the oldest son, then the mother, and last of all, the younger children. The baby would be bathed last, and by then, the story goes, the water was so filthy, it was easy to lose the baby in the bathwater, especially if you looked away for a minute and the baby sank down in the water. This is where it gets very strange. So the tale goes, occasionally the baby would get thrown out with the bathwater. Personally, I found that explanation a little unlikely. And the urban myth debunking website that you should all know about, Snopes.com, agrees with me about that. While nobody knows who first coined that saying, it seems to come from Germany. And the first published appearance of it is in a 15th century book of German poems. But most interesting to me is that one of the first people to use it in print was Martin Luther, who in a 1526 letter wrote, Man soll das Kind nicht mit dem Bad ausgießen, which translated is, one should not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Some would say Luther did that in some cases. Its first use in English comes from British essayist Thomas Carlyle in 1849. Isn't Google wonderful? I suppose I probably first heard this saying from one of my grandmothers. They were always going around uttering quaint advice like, now watch your P's and Q's, and I still don't know what that means. But this saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, however quaint and odd sounding it seems to be, is Paul's advice in 1 Thessalonians 5. In verses 19 through 20. There he instructs them, using my own translation, do not quench the spirit or despise prophecies. Carefully examine all things and hold on to what is good. And then in the next verse, 21, reject what is harmful. Some English translations translate the word dokimazeta, prove. The King James Version translates it prove, and so do some others. Thus rendering the verse in English, prove all things. Of course, that doesn't make any sense in modern English. How can you prove things that contradict each other? But in the past, the word prove in English could mean test or examine. And today it generally means that. And so most modern English translations say examine all things. So a workable translation of that verse is critically examine everything. Now, Thayer says that the word means to test, to examine, to prove, to scrutinize, to see whether a thing is genuine or not, as in testing metals such as gold or silver. And it's often used in the New Testament and in the Septuagint, almost always meaning critically examining something to prove its validity or not. Now, the context in 1 Thessalonians is prophecies. Paul instructs the Thessalonian Christians not to despise prophecies. He immediately then instructs them, though, to critically examine everything, which, of course, raises the question for us, and probably did for the Thessalonians, how? How do we examine prophecies? And Paul doesn't give us the answer, and we can only wish that he had. My only intention in choosing this passage as a text that has shaped me, though, is to support and defend something that I find is much neglected in Christian communities, and perhaps especially in conservative ones. That something that's much neglected is critical thinking and testing of things within the church and within Christian organizations. But then Paul goes on to say that after they have tested the prophecies, or whatever is to be examined and tested, they are to hold firmly to what is good. And the implication, of course, is they should discard whatever is bad. Now, as a sidebar here, I do wish Paul had given us some criteria for testing prophecies. I think he should have. And maybe it was in the original manuscript, but it's missing now. And only the original manuscripts were inerrant, as we know. So a few years ago, Christianity Today magazine asked me to provide some criteria for testing prophecies. There was an outbreak of prophecy in Kansas City among some charismatic Christians there, and it was spreading all over the country, and people were flying to Kansas City to hear these prophecies, to receive their own personal prophecy, and so forth. And so in an editorial in Christianity Today, I offered what Paul should have, so I filled in the gaps for him. I gave five tests for prophecies: the Christ touchstone, the apostolic norm, the unity criterion, the sanity check — that's the most controversial one — and the Messiah test. So if you're interested in having those, I'll be happy to give you a photocopy of that editorial. Well, I'll never forget when this text first really hit home to me. You know that aha moment when experience and text come together, and suddenly it means something very existentially compelling to you personally. And that happened to me, though I don't remember the day or the date, but I remember the place and the approximate time. It was then that this text became a great comfort and challenge to me. You see, I grew up in a form of Christianity most of you can't even imagine. Sometimes I'm even embarrassed to talk about it. Something interesting happened yesterday, as I had already prepared this and was thinking about it. A woman came up and rang the doorbell at our house, and it turned out to be someone that my wife and I went to Bible college with, like 40 years ago, almost. And so we sat and reminisced about that. And when I find myself with someone like that, that grew up in the same form of Christianity that I did and endured the same things, I want to say, hey, let's form a support group. And that's what we did yesterday afternoon. Often I find that they, the people I'm talking to, went one of two directions: either deeper into that form of life, uncritically accepting everything about it, or farther and farther away, until they rejected everything. You see, the religious form of life I was raised in was almost cultic in its extreme legalism. I've come to refer to us as urban Amish. We lived in a city, but we regarded everything and everyone around us as bound for hell unless they repented and joined our group or something very much like it. Yesterday, with this friend from years ago, she was telling us about how her mother would send her to vacation Bible school at a Catholic church and a Lutheran church just to get rid of her for a week during the summer. And it was there that she first realized that people other than us could be saved. And she went home to tell her mother, and her mother said, "No, they can't. You're just going there to, you know, spend some time." Well, television was held in great suspicion by us. It tended to come and go in our home. Our first television was a rented set so that I would have something to do while I was bedridden for a summer with rheumatic fever when I was 10 years old. Now, a 10-year-old can only read the Bible so long, and reading the Bible was strongly emphasized in our home and in our church. Anyone who had not read the Bible all the way through, including all the begats, by the time he or she was 12, was considered probably destined for hell. Well, the television stayed for a little while after I got better, but then it went back to the rental store, and we didn't have another one for years. Movies were absolutely verboten. After all, what if Jesus came back while you were sitting in a den of Hollywood iniquity where people were having sex in the back seats? Seriously, that's what my Sunday school teacher said. I didn't darken the door of a movie theater till I was 20, and I was sure God was going to strike me dead. Well, I think you get the picture, but more pertinent to my story than all the rules and regulations that governed almost every minute aspect of life was the one great unspoken rule that was always enforced but never explained. And that one great rule was, don't ask why. Of course, it was okay to ask why if you asked it with the right spirit and in the right attitude, that is, one of humble acceptance of whatever answer was offered, and then you shut up. But if you asked why, really challenging a rule or a belief or a custom, you'd better watch out. Your eternal soul was in jeopardy, and I really do not exaggerate. You see, our form of Christianity was not garden variety fundamentalism. We considered fundamentalist Baptists liberals because they didn't believe in the supernatural gifts of the Spirit, such as speaking in tongues and healing. Now, my stepmother was the epitome of our spiritual way of life. When we went on family vacation, we had to find a church as close to our own in beliefs and practices as possible and attend it on Sunday morning during vacation. We had to go to Sunday school and all, which I always dreaded, visiting another church, because when I was 15, I looked 12. And so when we would go in, the deacon or usher or whoever would say, "Now, he goes to this Sunday school class," and he would always be 5 years younger than me. So even when I was in college and on a road trip, I stopped and went to a church in Winslow, Arizona on a Sunday morning because I was conditioned to do that. You just had to go to church on Sunday morning. And they put me in the junior high class. Well, as I was saying, my mother was the epitome. I got punished one time for coming home from school and putting a school book on top of a Bible that was sitting on a table. My brother and I weren't allowed to wear cutoffs, even cutoff jeans, to say nothing of shorts, or swim with girls, which meant no swimming in any public pools. Occasionally, our church would rent a YMCA swimming pool for an afternoon or an evening, but the boys sat out while the girls swam, and vice versa. Well, my problem was that I pretty much kept all the rules. And yet, I had a really hard time getting along because I kept questioning the rules. Why this rule? Why that belief? And when the answers weren't satisfying, I kept asking. When I was in sixth grade, I must have asked one too many questions during Sunday school, because I'll never forget. The teacher stood up, threw down the teacher's quarterly, and said, "Roger, you teach the class," and walked out. I did teach the class, but I got a spanking that afternoon. Now, if you grew up in our church, there was only one option for college, our denomination's Bible college. Everyone went there. And the few who chose not to go there, that put a big question mark over their spirituality. Going to that college was a deal breaker. Not to go there was to be partially shunned by family and friends. So, against the advice of all my high school teachers, I went there. And I suffered 4 years of hell. We were not allowed to ask questions in class unless it was simply for clarification of a point. The whole curriculum and the whole pedagogy was about indoctrination. And there was a deep strain of anti-intellectualism in the school. But I simply couldn't stop myself from asking the why question. Why do we believe that? Where does that tradition come from? Why do we do that? And most often the answers were less than satisfactory, and I kept asking, so I was labeled a troublemaker for persisting in my questioning. At a particularly low point in my college career, I came across this verse in Thessalonians, "Examine all things." And I felt released from guilt and condemnation. I came to realize that I was being spiritually abused, that I was right and they were wrong, that my elders had created idols out of highly questionable beliefs and practices and were using shame to manipulate and control students, especially the few of us who dared to question the idols. I'll never forget the day the college president called me into his office, and instead of talking to me about my questions, told me not to come back to school the next day unless I got my hair cut. You see, my hair was down to about the middle of my ears and slightly over my collar, but men were not allowed to have long hair or any facial hair, including sideburns. But I never could grow sideburns, so that wasn't a problem. I did get my hair cut, but that was kind of a turning point for me. I knew I was being singled out for special abuse because of my constant subjecting of things to critical examination, and yet that's what I read in the Bible we were supposed to do. During the second semester of my senior year, I was told later, the college's Board of Regents discussed not allowing me to graduate in spite of my grade point average, which was 3.5. They finally decided they probably couldn't legally prevent me from graduating, but agreed among themselves to blackball me from ever finding a position in the denomination. Well, all of that is simply to explain. After those experiences, I was tempted to run as far as I possibly could from that form of Christianity. We called ourselves conservative evangelicals, among other things. Did I even want to be an evangelical Christian anymore? I wasn't sure. But I kept coming back to a few really amazing experiences of the reality of Jesus Christ in my life that I had during those times. And those kept me anchored in my evangelical faith, even as I slowly shook off the extreme fundamentalism and legalism and anti-intellectualism of my home and church and denomination. The last straw for my family and my church and my denomination was when I dared to enroll in seminary. I was the first person raised in my denomination ever to go to seminary. My people called it cemetery. Enrolling in a Baptist seminary assured that I was really never fully welcome among them again. But at that seminary, I found a very different flavor of evangelical Christianity, a warm-hearted but at the same time tough-minded evangelicalism that was not at all threatened by my questions. And I kept asking my questions and kept waiting for the sky to fall, but it never did. And even when they didn't know the answers, they said, "That's a good question. Let's keep asking and wrestling with that." And I'd go, "What? You can do that?" So I drank deeply at the wells of what I call open, progressive, evangelical theology, and it tasted so good. As I progressed on into my doctoral studies, I met many young men and women who had grown up in religious environments like my own, and I noticed a pattern. It seemed that they either were incapable of thinking for themselves, or they rejected evangelical Christianity entirely. And I determined to do what I didn't see very many of them doing, to keep the baby while throwing out the bathwater. It hasn't always been easy. Where's the line between legalism and righteousness? Where's the line between traditionalism and tradition? Where's the line between fanaticism and passion? Between authoritarianism and authority? Between gullibility and openness to miracles? Over the years, I've witnessed so many young Christians in university and seminary struggling out of abusive fundamentalism with its near idolatry of human ideas and traditions and its abuse of inquiring minds. And I've been dismayed by how often they do throw the baby of evangelical faith out with the bathwater of fundamentalism, but I can't blame them because I came very close to doing that myself. Now I've become a little more comfortable in my own skin, and knowing the difference between the baby and the bathwater comes easier for me, but not always completely easy. And I need to be patient with those who are still finding their way in that. I want to give them guidance if I can. So let me tell you some of the things I think we should keep as we discard their counterfeits. We should not throw the baby of tradition out with the bathwater of traditionalism. Historical theologian Yaroslav Pelikan of Yale said that traditionalism is the dead faith of the living, while tradition is the living faith of the dead. We should not throw the baby of certitude out with the bathwater of certainty. Kierkegaard coined the term certitude as the replacement for enlightenment certainty, which is a myth. We finite and fallen human beings can't have certainty, especially about answers to life's ultimate questions, but we can have certitude, which means, in Leslie Newbegin's words, proper confidence. We should not throw the baby of confession out with the bathwater of creedalism. I will no longer ever sign someone else's creed or confessional statement, but if asked, I will gladly tell my own confession of faith in classical Christian doctrine. We should not throw the baby of faith out with the bathwater of anti-intellectualism, or the baby of reason out with the bathwater of rationalism. We should not throw the baby of truth out with the bathwater of totalizing absolutism. We should not throw the baby of feeling out with the bathwater of emotionalism. We should not throw the baby of patriotism out with the bathwater of nationalism. We should not throw the baby of God's supernatural activity out with the bathwater of gullibility about miracle stories. We should not throw the baby of biblical authority out with the bathwater of wooden literalism and strict inerrancy. We should not throw the baby of accountability out with the bathwater of hierarchy. And so I could go on. There are so many examples of ways in which disillusioned Christians throw the good out with the bad. So how can we know which is the baby and which is the bathwater? There's no litmus test that always works. I haven't found one anyway. It would be too simple to just say Jesus, but a Christ-centered consciousness is part of it. But one thing I'm sure of, in our Christian communities, we need to find ways to reward and not punish those courageous souls among us who dare to ask why and keep asking it, because they do us a great service by making us ask about the difference between the baby and the bathwater. Pray with me, please. Lord, I thank you for all the students here and throughout the campus who are struggling in their own ways with aspects of their religious background, their heritage, their tradition. But I pray that you will give them guidance by your Holy Spirit and help them to know what is the baby and what is the bathwater and how to hold on to that which is good while examining everything around them. It's not easy, Lord, and we confess our failings, but we ask for your help. In Jesus' name, amen.